Washington versus William Selley. You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Barbara Corey, and I represent William Barry Selley, the appellant in this case. Mr. Selley was convicted.
Do you wish to reserve any time for
3 minutes? 3 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Selley was convicted of murder in the second degree with aggravating factors for the death of his longtime girlfriend, Kate. And they had been a couple for some years, and they did not have the type of dramatic relationship that the state has portrayed in its brief. They had their ups and downs in the relationship, and they had fights, and several of them became physical, and they had a final disagreement that resulted in Kate's death. That disagreement began at a bar. They both unfortunately drank a lot of alcohol, where with another person they consumed 17 to 20 drinks of hard liquor and had difficulty getting into their car. Kate fell from the bar stool at the bar. She had some difficulty getting to the car. She was helped to the car by two gentlemen. My client was intoxicated, had difficulty driving, and when they reached their home in Gig Harbor, Kate had a hard time getting out of the car. And so my client, who goes by the name of Barry, tried to help her out. They were both drunk. And so when he pulled her out of the car, she fell. He pulled her up again. They both fell. And this happened as they walked into the house. My client was looking for the keys to the house. Neither one of them could produce them. And he kept saying, and you'll have to pardon my language because this becomes relevant, but he kept saying, "Where are the fucking keys?" And he said this loudly. One of the neighbors later transmogrified that statement into, "I'm going to fucking kill you." And she came up with that statement when she testified at trial some years later. When Barry could not find the keys and open the house, he kicked the door open and they got into the house. This was early on a Monday morning. Throughout, from Monday until Wednesday night, Barry stayed home with Kate. Kate continued to be very ill from her severe intoxication that night, and Barry took care of her. She fell during the house. She fell while she was in there. She fell down the stairs. She fell getting up. She fell walking around, and she had bruises. And she had bruises that were noted at the hospital to be bruises of different colors. And the different colors of the bruises indicated that they were inflicted at different times. Now, on Wednesday, Kate became very ill. And she became very ill from blunt force trauma to her abdomen. And that perforated her colon. And that resulted in the spilling of essentially, you know, gut material into her body, and that resulted in peritonitis. There's a golden hour for treatment in that, and had she presented at the hospital during those couple of hours, that could have been successfully treated. Now, during these days up to this colon injury, Kate didn't want to get medical treatment for her injuries. And she's an adult, and she chose not to get medical treatment. She was getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And so finally, Barry and his mother decided that Kate needed an ambulance, and they called 911, and Kate was taken to the hospital. It was too late, and Kate died. And the medical examiner determined that the injury to the colon was blunt force trauma. And the issue at trial then was how this blunt force trauma was sustained. And there were various theories to that, one of which, of course, was that my client struck her. Other theories were that she had some type of weakness or sickness or illness to the colon, that it was difficult to prove because the colon had ruptured. And so when you looked at the hole in the colon, you couldn't really tell what had caused it. So that was a significant issue at trial. Now, to prove its case, the state looked at a history of what they perceived to be domestic violence between Kate and Barry. And they looked at these prior incidents. One was an incident where Kate was alleged to have run from Barry when Kate said that Barry was mad at her for talking to men at a bar, and Barry said that Kate wanted more drinks at home, and he didn't want to give them to her, and so she ran in the woods. There was another incident when Kate said that Barry had picked up a heavy television stand and threw it at her, and she thought she broke his ribs, and she was x-rayed at the hospital, and nothing was wrong with her. Her brother took pictures, and they were on her legs. And the last incident was an incident where Barry supposedly told a friend that he had hit her and caused her to vomit, and that had occurred in May or June. And then he switched his story when a detective said, well, are you sure that didn't happen in October? And so the state used essentially this factual evidence to convict Mr. Selle. And their story was predicated on the prosecutor adducing evidence early on that people didn't get injured this way from what the prosecutor called ground falls. And the prosecutor had witnesses, nurses, medics come in and define ground fall. And a ground fall is what happens when, for example, an elderly person, you know, is walking and just falls. Or another person is walking and just falls because they become dizzy. Just a flat-out fall. It's not a fall when somebody is drunk and gets pulled by someone else. It's not that kind of fall. And so the state, from the get-go, was eviscerating the defense case by trying to misrepresent the evidence from the get-go in the case and always suggesting to the jury that Kate had suffered something that she had not. And so by basically telling the jury from the get-go, the state was misrepresenting and denying the defense any opportunity to put on its case.
All right, you'll have 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Jason Reif on behalf of Respondent, State of Washington. Beginning first with Ms. Corey's characterization of the case, I think when the court looks at what I tried to have a painstakingly cited record in this, and basically if you look at all the footnotes in the brief, what you'll find is me going over each witness, each medical witness, and trying to provide this court where the evidence of this case can be found, as opposed to when you look at appellate's brief, you'll often find that you get a hypothetical posed to a medical expert about a theoretical possibility, and the expert says, well, scientifically, I can't rule that out. And that is what appellant is using in this case as any kind of corroboration of what it is that her version of the case that she's providing to this court. And I would also add, if you look at the opening statement here, it's almost exclusively from Mr. Selle's point of view when he testified. But of course, the standard of sufficiency of the evidence is taking the light and most favorable to the state, with all reasonable inferences to be drawn in favor of the state. And when this court does that, what you'll see is uniformly between among the medical experts, high velocity trauma, small object, impacts, bruising, punctated, focused, like bruises, fists, or covered shoes. You'll see cranial bleeding, gastrointestinal bleeding, a collapsed lung, twice lacerated liver that the ER doctor says is consistent with what he sees from football players on the field. It's so rare. In the perforated colon, and that when you look at Dr. Clark's opinion here, he's focusing on that because the kind of extreme trauma that would require to cause that kind of injury was so rare that the doctor who went in there to do the surgery actually had the finding peer-reviewed because it's so irregular. And you'll get analogies like kicked by a horse, right? And so when you move beyond that physical evidence and the medical evidence that should be accepted in a light most favorable to the state, and you expand out into, one, these incidents of prior domestic violence were admitted for two reasons, one, to support the aggravating factor, but also for absence of mistake, to cut against this theory of accident that he just was looking out for Kate Southward's well-being and he was somehow being respectful of her by not calling 911. When you see in October of 2011 a prelude basically to this incident where he explains getting angry, beating her, she finds herself languishing on a couch, very similar condition, vomiting dark fluids and the like, ultimately becomes concerned that she's not going to make it, so he reaches out to his manager at the car dealership, who happens to have a medical provider as a girlfriend, to see what's going on, what to do about this. And again, he has his mother there taking care of Kate as opposed to calling 911. You see, fast forward, almost just a year to the day almost, you have this incident that happens in September that kills her. And again, you have him picking up his mother to try to treat her on the couch, driving past a relative who happened to be a physician who testified, and instead of calling 911, he gets his mother to the house, and it's only when she gets there and that we have a sense of what Kate's condition looks like once the medical respondents get there that she urges the defendant to call 911. And that's when it happens. When the first responders come to the scene, the defendant goes up, and instead of saying, "Hurry, get to my girlfriend, I think she might be dying," he holds them up there, and they both make it very clear, the lieutenant in particular, trying to repeat a story. "Well, we were drunk. We fell over a couple of ladders. I got home," and again repeating his exculpatory account of what happens there. Meanwhile, they're trying to get into the house, and he says, "Well, it looks like I beat the shit out of her," right? Later on, this becomes a point in closing argument because the state's point is, it's right, because the evidence establishes that he did.
And so one of the main arguments for reversal is prosecutorial misconduct, not just in closing argument, but throughout the trial. What's your response to the different allegations or assertions related to prosecutorial misconduct?
Well, there are, as the court knows, there are a number, and they kind of...
You don't have to do each one of them, but...
Well, I would say that they're baseless, Your Honor. I mean, we have in the court's finding at there was a motion for basically a new trial here, and you have the trial court finding that the prosecutor did not commit misconduct in this case. But when you...
So were the same arguments raised in the motion for new trial?
The primary argument there was the closing argument and what she perceived to be a plea to passion and prejudice of the jury. And so I guess I'll start with closing argument, I guess, and work back. You know, there's been a lot of discussion.
Wasn't the appellant more focused on the reply argument? That's what crossed the line?
The rebuttal?
The rebuttal argument? I'm sorry, the rebuttal argument.
Yes, Your Honor. And so I guess if I were to focus there, I would say, one, when we're looking at rebuttal argument, we're looking at a different standard because prosecutors there are able to make a fair reply. One of the remarks that the defendant focuses on here is the statement, it appears, you know, that "I must have sat through a different case," is what she calls denigration of counsel. And when you look at the case law on denigration of counsel, what you're looking at is somebody who, examples would be using the prestige of the prosecutor's office against a defense counsel. And you'll see arguments, "Well, I stand for justice," and they're just zealously advocating for the accused. Or something about them being deceptive or underhanded, as opposed to...
So we're talking about examples such as in Thorgerson or in Monday.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And then I think Warren kind of captures it's a later case, and it refers to Thorgerson and the like.
Which case?
Warren.
Oh, Warren.
Correct.
I think Warren,
I just, in that it provides kind of a survey of the cases that came before it on impugning counsel's character or credibility. And that's the other one. You'll see something referring to deceptive tactics, or they're just twisting words.
What about passion and prejudice?
So then we're talking about this, the argument of it looks like this is what getting the shit beat out of you looks like, is the argument that objection has been, or challenge has been raised to. And ultimately, it didn't come with a timely objection. It came later by way of a motion for a new trial on prosecutorial
misconduct. Well, I think the court, our Supreme Court has said that that's okay, so.
I was trying to put it into procedural context, Your Honor. And so what we have here is a statement from the defendant to Hughes, and I provide a specific citation to page 22. You'll find on footnote 103 a chain of events that shows this was a statement that the first responder got from the defendant who came to the curb.
Right.
It looks like I beat the shit out of her. So first, in context of what this court has received counsel's a characterization of the argument in all caps with exclamation points, with discussion of counsel or trial prosecutor pacing around the courtroom in a way that is not in this record. So what you do have is the statement, this is what, holding up a picture of the victim, this is what getting the shit beat out of you looks like. And so in terms of an argument that's supported by the evidence, this is turning the phrase that the defendant offered as basically to try to mitigate what they were going to about to confront so that they didn't walk in and immediately assume as much when they looked at her, tying it to the medical evidence that supports that she was truly beaten to death in this case and that these were small object, violent force, punches or kicks, that type of injury. And so it's directly supported by the evidence. And she's holding up the pictures of her, citing the defendant's words, it looks like I beat the shit out of her, this is what getting the shit beat out of you looks like. And it's all supported by the evidence, and she's showing a picture and putting the defendant's phrase in context, the point being that when he said that to them, even though it was clear that he was trying to minimize or mitigate somehow their initial shock of seeing this woman on the couch, who by this point all the blood had failed to reach peripheral systems, and she's filled with toxins coming from her liver not being able to process it, and it's not until they get her halfway across the bridge that they're able to oxygenate and provide enough fluids where she's able to even speak. And putting this dramatic situation in context, and I would say very succinctly, that this is the defendant's excuse. It's clear that when you look at the evidence, there's truth in it, but not the truth that he was trying to communicate. And so when you look at the evidence and you look at how it was framed in terms of the defendant's statement, it invoked that statement, it turned it around, and it was proper argument, Your Honor. And it's certainly, when you look at the context of the great weight of evidence that comes not only from a neighbor hearing, he's going to kill me, help, help, before the crash, I'm sorry, and you add that to the other evidence of the defendant trying to conceal the fact of this injury, and when you look at it in a light most favorable to the state, there just simply is such overwhelming evidence of what it is that he did to her, both in terms of the DV incident and the murder itself, that there's nothing that this turn of phrase at the end of the closing argument could do to, I mean, I have it cited here. You have something like 40 witnesses, 2 months of trial, over 100 exhibits, and the idea that this comment and rebuttal that's turning a defendant's phrase and supporting by the evidence could be something that would require reversal, I would submit to this court is not reasonable.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Help, help, he's going to kill me. A statement that comes out at trial, 3 years after the killing, the woman goes back to bed, sleeps, never mentions it at all till she's on the witness stand. Judge the credibility of that. The statement, looks like I beat the shit out of her, comes out and originates from the 911 operator. That was not contested at trial. The only person who heard it was Medic Hughes. He was not the medic who was with Mr. Selly when they walked up to the house. He was in the periphery. The medics who were by Mr. Selly never heard that. Hughes must have heard it off the radio. So for the prosecutor to walk in front of the jury and hold up pictures and say, this is what it looks like to have the shit beaten out of you. This is what it looks like to have the shit beaten out of you is highly prejudicial. It's the end of her argument. Lindsay holds.
So you're relying on Lindsay? Is that the most analogous case?
I'm relying on the language in Lindsay that rebuttal argument is the prosecutor's can be said to be the most potent part of a prosecutor's presentation to the jury. It's one of the last things that they hear. And what they heard in this case was a passionate plea by the prosecutor that this is what it looks like to have the shit beaten out of you. It wasn't Mr. Selle's statement. She attributed it to Mr. Selle, and she showed grotesque and graphic photographs to the jury.
Didn't the EMT testify that Mr. Selle made that statement to him?
One of the EMTs did, but the record also shows what? No, it wasn't to him. It was, well, the group was walking up to the house. It wasn't to him.
Okay, so, but he said Mr. Selle made the statement while he was
there. He said he heard the statement. None of the other EMTs in the group heard it. And I think that's important because they were closer to him, but it's uncontroverted that when the call went out by the 911 operator, that's what the 911 operator said.
So what,
that's where the statement originated.
What case are you relying on for the argument that that was an impermissible appeal to passion and prejudice?
I think that Lindsay basically holds that you can't make statements like that. Lindsay holds, and this also goes for her statement at the beginning of argument, that, you know, the prosecutor, she says, what I think after hearing the defense closing is that we must have sat through different trials, is similar to the statement in Lindsay where the prosecutor got up and said, what you've just heard is a crock, and not referring to a piece of pottery. And the statement that, you know, this is what it looks like is every bit as emotional, every bit as passionate, every bit as likely to stir the jury up as they're going back into the jury room. That coupled with all of our other errors, which we've supported with meticulous cites to the record, warrant reversal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.